he is the last human speaker. Then God will speak next. And that's pretty much the book. There'll be a short chapter at the end that gives us how the situation in Job's life was resolved. So I think counting today, we have four classes left. This is where we were, where we finished up Wednesday night. We began or spent the bulk of our time in Elihu's speeches. He had said both good things and bad things. He seems to me to be wiser than the three. He is saying things with more tact than Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar said collectively. He speaks very eloquently, though he's younger. And as we recall, the reason why he did not speak when the other three spoke, the book tells us, out of respect for them, it says age should speak first, and so he let them have their say. And when he determined that they had nothing else to add, then he began to chime in. And that's how he got into the discussion. He viewed the situation, he said, but you know, sometimes the age is not always the wisest. And that is true in this situation because the three older friends have misspoken, at times very grievously misspoken, insinuated and accused Job of things that were not true. So that got under Elihu's skin, so to speak. That got his dander up, and he spoke against them. He also spoke against Job, too, some things that Job had said that were not proper, and we looked at those also. But here are the slides that he says, I waited and I listened, but now I'm going to speak. So the thing that I wanted to mention with respect to Job was this chart right here. Chapter 33, verses 8 through 11. The wisest thing that had been said to Job so far, Elihu had heard what he said, and he said, Job, you've not been right in saying this. And he was correct. When Job had charged God, blamed God, if you will, laid everything at God's feet, God's mistreating me, God is not being fair with me, judging God, if you will. And Elihu said, that's not proper, that's not correct. So this is where we want to pick up now this morning. We didn't get to this slide. Wednesday night, chapter 33, verses 19 through 22 is where we left off, is that Elihu opens up the possibility. Now, again, well, let me put it this way. Elihu is not saying, this is what's happening, Job. This is why this is happening to you. If he had said that, then he'd be as guilty as who? As the other guys have been saying the same thing. But Elihu was saying, Job, perhaps this is why this is happening. Now, is he still correct or incorrect in that? As we know the situation in the book. No, it's incorrect. That's not why this is happening. But I just want you to see, and we're emphasizing all throughout Elihu's speech, his approach is different and much better than the approach of the three. Much, much better. More tactful. Instead of accusing, he's just suggesting. Now, his suggestion is just as wrong as the accusations of the three friends, but at least he's not coming across as inflammatory and very accusatory in respect to Job's plight. He says that God chastens man with pain. Does God do that in the realm of men? Has God chastened men with pain in the past? Sure, he has. Can God still do that today? Absolutely. Does God do that today? Well, we don't know. He might. He might very well do that to get our attention. But he says, Job, this is perhaps why this is all happening to you. So he's rebuking Job's complaints, which was correct to do that. Such a man, he says in verses 23 through 26 of chapter 33, should be gracious to those who come and talk to him. And what I want you to consider there, this again, that's verses 23 through 26. If there is an angel as a mediator, perhaps Elihu saw himself as an angel. I mean, not literally, but in the sense of as a mediator, one who's been sent to speak to man, to remind man what is right for him, verse 23, then let him be gracious to him and say, deliver him from going down to the pit, I have found ransom. Now, just a suggestion here, a question. Do you think that Elihu maybe is endorsing the three friends? Maybe he's saying to Job, you know, these three men, they've been saying to you what they think is right, and you have been a little hard on them. You maybe should be gracious to them. That's a possibility. I think more or less I'd be inclined to say that Elihu refers to himself here. He thought he was speaking for God. Yes. Yes, Elihu was upset and angry with the three friends and how they had talked to Job. How they could not answer Job when Job answered their question. Yes. Yes, absolutely. So whether he refers to the friends, to himself, or just men in general, he says when someone is in this type of situation and someone come to him, the one who's receiving the rebuke, if you will, needs to be gracious. Is that a truth that we need to accept? Yes, that's a truth. That's a biblical truth. That could be substantiated from the New Testament. Jesus taught on that as well. Such a man, when he recovers, he says in verse 27 to 28 that he'll be able to help others. I have sinned and perverted what is right. He has redeemed my soul from going to the pit. So here, this would be, and I hesitate to use the word testimony, like we're all the time out here trying to witness, but this would be a testimony of the sort that God has redeemed me. God has saved me from the ruin that I was headed toward because of my behavior. And that would certainly be true. But again, in Job's case, it's not true. Again, that's not why all this is happening. So that's what Elihu is suggesting. Okay. Now here's to me the most powerful thing that Elihu says to this point. Look in verse 29. And again, your version may be different than mine. Elihu says, "Behold, God does all these." That is what he's been talking about. And Elihu is saying, God brings chastisement. God treats man the way that he has. And Job, I perceive, in this situation, mine says, oftentimes with men. Are there alternate readings? What does the New King James say?
Twice,
in fact, three times. All right. He seems to be saying, Job, you know, sometimes God deals with men in this way. And he's leaving open the possibility that this could very well be your situation. That's how God has done men in the past. And it would not be untoward for God to do that in this situation if, in fact, and what's the big if as it applies to Job? If he had sinned. Now, of course, we know he has not. But Elihu doesn't know that. The only one who knows that he's not sinned is who? Well, besides God. God knows everything, but Job knows he's not sinned. And he has persisted in maintaining his innocence all throughout the debate. So what I want you to see is the difference here. The three had said what to Job? I mean, blanketly said, Job, you have sinned. Now, that's just the way that is. God would not be treating you the way that he's treating you if you were innocent in the matter. So that was their approach. Elihu's approach is, Job, you might be guilty. Do you see the difference? Very tactful. There is a great difference between these two approaches. And Elihu is just saying that God deals with men sometimes this way, and perhaps, Job, this is your plight. This is your situation. So you need to consider that. And very tactful. And I wanted to stress that part of Elihu's speech as it pertained to Job. Okay. Now, he then says toward the end of this speech, now you listen to me look at verse 32. He says, after you listen to me, then I'm willing to do what? Well, then I'm willing to listen to you. He said, you answer me whatever I have said. But you hear me out first, and then I'm going to hear you out. Well, have you seen the three friends say something like that? I have. They've not said that. Not like Elihu said. All right, now we get to the last three chapters, and this will go a little more quickly because we can look at these three, particularly in chapters 36 and 37. You can lump great sections of text together. And I'm not trying to ignore the text. You can't cover Job verse by verse in a quarter. It's just not possible. But we can look at it thematically or looking at it section-wise. He now seems to be saying more words to the friends, if you will. He rebukes them tactfully. Hear my words, you wise men, listen to me. The ear tests words as the palate tastes food. Let us choose for ourselves what is right. That's a kind rebuke. It seems to be that's what he's saying. One should always make sure that what one says is right and what is good. As the stomach would, or as the palate would discern between bad tasting food and good tasting food, men will discern between words that are kind and easy to receive and words that are harsh. And they've not said anything kind to Job. It's all been harsh. So he's reminding them also, you need to treat Job in a better way. You've not been kind and gracious to him. He reminds them then of Job's own words. Look at verses 5 and 6. For Job has said, now he's quoting, had Job said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my right? Had he said that? Yes, he had said that. God's not being fair with me. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. Job was linking his wound, that is, his suffering, with the absence of a transgression. And Job says, I'm not being treated fairly. So he said, now Job said these things, and we referenced up here, chapter 13, verse 18, and 27, verse 2. Those were words of Job that harmonize with what what Elihu quotes Job as saying here in chapter 34. So we at least know Elihu was there to hear that, because he makes reference to that, to those words of Job. Now, this is where it gets kind of sticky. Even though he's been kind to Job, he seems to agree with the three friends on Job's supposed guilt. Look in verses 7 through 9 of chapter 34. What man is like Job? And then how does he describe him? Such a man does what? Drinks scorn like water, and what else? Look at verse 8. Now, where's the evidence of that? Who's he sound like now? He sounds like the three friends. Mine says, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men. There's no proof of that. So, does Elihu agree with the friends, or does he agree with Job? Well, I don't know. He seems to be straddling the fence. This doesn't sound as tactful as before when he said to Job, now Job, perhaps you may be guilty of sin. Now he says, well, look at Job. He does these kind of things. And that's the same approach that the friends have used with respect to Job. So that's why some have struggled with, well, what good did Elihu do in this debate? What contributions did he make? Did he say anything different than the friends did? Yes, he did. Did he say anything like the friends did? It appears that he did. He may think Job is guilty as now. So the main thing that Elihu comes to do, I think, is to speak for God. Now, did God send Elihu? There's no evidence of that. But he feels the need nonetheless to speak up for Jehovah, especially since he has heard the three friends speak and he didn't like what they had to say and thought he could speak better and defend truth in this situation in a better way, seems to be. Through verses 10 to 15 of this chapter, that's what he chooses to do. That's what he decides to do, is to speak on behalf of God. So here's his defense of God. God will not do wickedness. Chapter 34, verse 10. Job accused God of being wicked? And that may seem a little harsh word to use, wicked, but had Job accused God of being unfair? He had. And Elihu says, now Job, and to the friends, with respect to Job's situation, God will not do injustice. God will not do these things to a man if he's innocent. That's not going to happen. And that's true. That's entirely true. God pays a man according to his work. Is that true? Sure. We must all stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account on what basis? For the deeds done in the body, whether they be good or evil. St. Corinthians. So Elihu speaks truth about that as well. God is sovereign, and he acts always at his discretion. Chapter 34, verses 14 and 15. if he should determine to do so, if he should gather to himself his spirit and his breath, that is to say, if God decides, all right, I'm just going to end the way things are right now, verse 15, what's Elihu say at the end of that? What about all flesh? Well, that's it. The life's over. And God can certainly choose to do that as sovereign. He certainly has such control over all the living. So again, he's just speaking for God here, it seems. He's continuing to defend God, 16 through 30. He says the wicked won't rule because they hate God. God won't use wicked men in such positions. Is that true? Well, no, I can think of some wicked rulers, even in this present day. So that's not entirely true. So again, we see a man who speaks truth and then he speaks things that are not true based on his perspective. And I guess when we wrap up all the human speeches, just as a way to summarize, all five men, and that includes Job, the three friends, Elihu and Job, they all spoke from failed perspectives, didn't they? Man doesn't know what God knows. And they spoke out of their ignorance. And I don't mean that to be that they're stupid. I just mean they are not aware of as much things as God is. And so they spoke from their limited wisdom. And here's an example of this. Elihu says, the wicked don't rule. God won't let them. Well, that's not true. We know that's not the case. God shows no partiality among men. Well, that's certainly true. We could find passages that speak of that in the New Testament. He's impartial to all. He's omniscient. 21 to 22. Yes, that is true. And Job doesn't need his day in court because God's omniscient. He's already aware of what's going on. Job, you don't need to go up before him and argue your case. He already is aware of all this. Verses 23 through 24. God does not need to consider a man further that he should go before God in judgment. You don't need to do this. What's Job been clamoring for the most? He wanted his day, didn't he? He wanted to argue his case before God and find out some answers. And Elihu said, Job, you don't need that day. God doesn't have to interact with you on that basis. He's already perfectly aware of all the intricate details of your situation. There's no purpose would be gained if you had that day in his court, so to speak. Harold, I think you're right. Harold is saying that Job has a perspective the other four don't have. And because of he's had this relationship with God that was stressed back at the beginning of the book, God commended Job. That's my servant. He's blameless, upright. The book never emphasizes, does it, that God has such a relationship with these other four men. It doesn't make that point. And I think that's worthy to be considered. Job, therefore, based on that, Job may have had a greater insight into the dealings of God and how God works among men. Of course, he still misspoke. Yes. But he still misspoke out of his suffering, out of his vexation of his spirit. He still said things he shouldn't have said. But he seems to enjoy something with God that the other four do not. Because God commends him. And there's never any such commendation of the other four. So again, God deals with men accordingly. And if God chooses to remain quiet, that is to say, Job, you asked for answers from God. No one's heard from Jehovah. So if he chooses to be quiet about this, who is man to question that? And that's true. That's true. Paul had to pray three times, did he not, before God finally answered him? Those first two times when he had that thorn in the flesh, and God didn't answer. Was that wrong of God to do that? No, we can't question God. God would choose to respond when and how he chooses in any given situation. All right. Now, he's continuing to rebuke Job, if you will. And look in verse 31 of chapter 34. And I think this is a question to Job. Not for Job to answer, but for Job to consider. Has anyone said to God, I have borne chastisement? That is, I have accepted this chastisement. Now, again, Elihu is considering the suffering of Job to be a chastisement in the first place, which it's not, but that's how he sees it. So Elihu says, has anybody heard anybody say, well, I'm going to receive and accept this chastisement from God, and I will not offend anymore. Well, nobody has said that, because Job didn't accept it as chastisement. That's not how he saw it. He saw it as unfair treatment, not just punishment for sin. That seems to be the difference of the two. So, look in verse 33, another rebuke to Job. He says, shall he recompense on your terms because you have rejected it? Job, what makes you think that God needs to deal with you when and how and where you want it? And is that what Job wanted? Job wanted it on his terms. He wanted to call God into question about this. And Elihu says, Job, God doesn't work that way. 2 Peter 3, with the Lord, a day is how long? As 1,000 years. And 1,000 years is... God doesn't act on our time. He doesn't have to answer to us. Again, Romans chapter 9, with a thing formed, say to him that formed it, why did you make me so? Does the clay have power over the potter? No, he does not. It's the other way around. And Job is that's the complaint that he had, and Elihu is rebuking him. Kindly, I think. Kinder than the other three have done. But it still is a rebuke nonetheless. Okay, so he reminds Job then that others will judge the situation differently than he has, as chapter 34 concludes. Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom. Job ought to be tried to the limit, verse 36, because he answers like wicked men. He has rebellion to his sin. That's the situation Job is in. Okay, now, more rebuke to Job, chapter 35. Look at what he said. First off, Elihu addresses the words of Job. This is the first 8 verses. Do you think this is according to justice? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, verse 3, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? We have heard this before from Job. Job had argued that righteous living was in vain. Go back real quickly. Look in chapter 9, verses 30 through 31. Job had actually made this statement. And I think Elihu seems to be referencing that now. Chapter 9 of Job. Look at verse 30. Matt, read those 2 verses for us. Chapter 9, 30 and 31.
If I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will plunge me into the pit with my own clothes and the corpse.
Even if I made myself as clean as I could, he said what to God? You still would do what? You still throw me in the pit. Accusation against God. And so Elihu says now about Job in chapter 35, for you say, now this is not a verbatim quote, but Elihu correctly judged Job's earlier words. For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? How am I any worse off now than if I hadn't sinned, which he knew he hadn't sinned, or rather than if I had sinned? I'm no worse off. I live faithfully. I'm treated this way. If I sin, I get rebuked. Job says, I don't see a difference between the two. They're the same to me. I'm not getting a fair shake here. And Elihu is going to rebuke him for that also, refute that kind of an argument. Now, here's something that Elihu said that's not correct. Look in verses 6 and 7 of chapter 35. If you sin, Job, if you have sinned, what do you accomplish against him? In other words, how do your sins affect him? God is so far superior to man that nothing that man does affects God. If your transgressions are many, verse 6, what do you do to him? Elihu seems to argue that God is not affected by the actions of men. Do you agree with that? I don't agree with that. Is God affected by man's sins? I believe he is. What did the Bible say in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 6? The great wicked situation of Noah's day? It grieved God in his heart. To what point he was so sorry that he regretted what? That he even made man in the first place. Ephesians 4 and verse 30. Grieve not the Holy Spirit. Well, that means we can grieve the Holy Spirit if we're told not to do it. That'd make no sense if you can't. If you can't affect God, grieve Him, then why be taught, now don't grieve God? That would make no sense. So man can grieve God. And in Psalm 147 and verse 11, it says that God is pleased with the righteousness of men. So to argue that God is not affected by the actions of men, that is not true. Absolutely. God is affected. God wants us to serve Him, and He's pleased with us when we do, and He's sorrowful when we don't. Oh, absolutely. Christ came because of man's actions. To say that God's not affected argues against the very sending of Christ. I think that's a good point. So, Elihu misspoke here in his attempts to magnify the great chasm between God and man. He said, now, Job, man's affected by what God does, but God isn't affected by what man does, whether you sin or do right. That's not so. He misspoke. Again, we see this limited wisdom on the part of man. He is not speaking as he ought to speak in terms of truly defending Jehovah like he is seeking out to do here. Now, look in chapter 35, verses 9 to 16. He first dealt with Job's words. Now he seems to be dealing with Job's cries for God, which Job had been crying for God all along throughout the book. Because of the multitude of oppressions, they, that is man, because of man's oppressions, they cry out. Now, according to Elihu, at the end of verse 9, why does man cry out? Because of what? Because of the arm of the mighty, my version says. Because they're feeling the weight of the behavior of other men. They just feel so overwhelmed and oppressed and put upon by other men, they cry out to God. But as Elihu sees it, look at verse 10. He doesn't hear anybody say what? Where's my Maker? So, Elihu seems to be saying, men only cry out to God or only cry out when what happens to them? Evil, bad. Men do not cry out, just in general, searching for who? God. Well, that's such a broad indictment. Is that always true? That's not true. Is the world full of people who only cry out to God when they get in the bad scrape? Yeah, that's true. But to say that no one cries out in search of just having a relationship with God, that's not true either. So again, we see more limited perspective here. And in Elihu's judgment, verses 12 and 13, those that cry out this way, Elihu says what? God's not going to answer. Because he sees that how? On the part of man. That's just pride. And God's not going to have anything to do with proud men. The Almighty will not regard it. Verse 13. All right, so again, I know I sound like a broken record, but it's some truth and some not true. He says some things that are right and some things are not right. So in terms of having a better perspective than the three friends, he doesn't. But he does speak wiser than they do, but he's not any better off in his speaking, if you will, in terms of representing all the truth than the three friends are. There's not that much of a difference, really. Okay. In judging Job's earlier cries for God, Elihu tells him, look in verse 14. He says, the case is before him, Job, and what do you have to do? You're going to have to do what? You're going to have to wait. Now, to me, that is the wisest thing said to Job yet in the whole book. Job, you're going to have to wait for God and find out from Him on His own time what possibly is the reason behind all this and how it's going to be resolved. Truer words have not been spoken. What about in your situation, in my situations in life, and they're not very pleasant ones? What are we going to have to do? We're going to have to wait. And you know what? The possibility exists that what? In terms of finding out the reason behind this bad stuff. You may never know. You may go to your grave and not know. You may find out. Providence may come your way 10, 20, 50 maybe years later, and you may find out. But you may not find out either. And that's up to God. And we can't question Him. And I know that's what we've been saying in terms of trying to find some overall lessons to take away from the book of Job. That's one of them. We're going to have to wait and just accept what happens, that in the end, who knows best? God knows best. He certainly does. And ours is not to question. Ours is to trust Him and know that all things work together for good. Romans 8. May not be what we want, but it'd be for our good. And that's God certainly knows that. So He tells Job, you're going to have to wait. He says, Job, you've spoken emptily. And you multiply words without knowledge. Verses 15, 16. That is true also. Job has done that. He has spoken words without knowledge. He has accused, blamed, if you will, held God responsible for all that's happened to him. And says, you shouldn't have done that, Job. That is not proper. That's the end of chapter 35. All right? I know I'm going rather quickly, but we have to wrap this up because I want to get to the speeches of Jehovah before we run out of time. Again, more desire on the part of Elihu, or need, as he sees it, to defend God. Verses 1 to 16. He says, I believe there's still much to be said on God's behalf. Chapter 36. That's the end of verse 2. Wait for me a little, and I will show you that there is yet more to be said in God's behalf. He just feels the need to speak for Jehovah in this debate. Everybody's present, but God's not there, and no one's speaking for God, but I'm going to speak for Him. So you all be quiet, and I've got more to say about Jehovah, if you will. God is mighty. He's used His power, verses 5 and 6. Let's see. God is mighty, but does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but give justice to the afflicted. Well, again, that's not entirely true. God doesn't always destroy the wicked. He will eventually destroy the wicked, won't He? I mean, He will, but not in life. He doesn't always destroy the wicked. And do the afflicted always get justice? Well, in the end they do, but how about in the present life? No. Look at our country. You don't always get justice if you've been wronged. So that's not entirely true either. Look in verses 7 through 12. He talked about setting up kings. He does not withdraw His eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne, He has seated them forever, and they are exalted. What if certain kings, rulers, are bound in fetters, verse 8, and they are caught in the cords of affliction? What if that happens to them? What does Elihu reason on that based on the way verse 9 reads? Yeah. In fact, he says they're guilty of what? Transgression. Who's that sound like? That sounds like the friends. He's saying the same thing the friends were saying. If you see somebody that's caught up in affliction, well, that's because God's judging them for transgression. So if that's his argument, then he's no better off. He's not making any more sense than the friends made. And that's not true. Just because someone's in affliction doesn't mean that they're guilty of sin, if you will. So he then appeals to God, or to Job rather. Look at verse 16 of chapter 36. It seems to be what he's saying. And some of Elihu's speech is rather, what's the word I want? Flowery. I mean, it's really poetically expressive and can be interpreted numerous ways. So I may not have this right. Maybe I do. But he says in verse 16, Job, he indeed enticed you from the mouth of distress. Instead of it, a broad place with no constraint. And that which was set on your table was full of fatness. Now that's, what in the world does that mean? Someone read that verse to me from the New King James. Verse 16. Whoever has that. Rob, you have that version? Chapter 36. Chapter 36. Verse 16. Okay, that seems to make a little better sense than my translation. He would have brought you out of distress into this place of no constraint. Seems to be what he's saying is, Job, God is using your present situation, perhaps He is, to bring you out of something distressful into a place of no constraint, a place of freedom, and in a place of fatness, prosperity. Now, has God done that in the past? Yes. What kind of situations did God lead Joseph through? Were they distressful situations? They absolutely were. His brothers hating him, throwing him in a hole in the ground, trying to kill him. Falsely accused of rape by Potiphar's wife, thrown in prison, forgotten by the cupbearer. Those weren't pleasant situations. But at last, where did Joseph wind up? Was it in a place of fatness, a place of no constraint? See, God can do that. But the problem with this, and again, I want to commend Elihu. He seems to be saying, perhaps that's what's happening with you, Job. He's not saying, well, that's what God is, exactly that's what He's doing. It's a perhaps. He's suggesting it. Now, it's not true. That's not what God is doing this. God's allowing Job to be tested for his faith to be made strong, but this is not why that was happening. But Elihu just says that's what God does with men sometimes. And so Job, be open to that possibility. Now, he continues his appeal to Job, and he says, Job, you're being judged. Again, verse 17 sounds a lot like the friends. This is judgment for sin. And he says, Job, don't scoff at such judgment. Don't mock it. Don't reject it. Look in verse 18 of chapter 36. Beware lest wrath entice you to scoffing. Do not let the greatness of the ransom, God trying to buy you or redeem you, ransom you from your situation, don't let that turn you aside. Will your riches keep you from distress or all the forces of your strength? One more appeal in verse 20. He says, Job, don't long for the night. When did Job long for the night? Back chapter 3, his opening lament. What did he long for? That he'd never had men born. He says, Job, don't long for that. Don't think little of chastisements. That seems to be what he's saying. Okay? Now, quickly before we end, he says in 21 through 23 of chapter 36, he says, be careful, Job, don't turn from good to evil. Well, that's always a good exhortation for anybody to hear. For you have preferred this to affliction. Behold, God is exalted in His power. Who's a teacher like Him? Who can teach God? Well, nobody can teach God. Be receptive to what is happening to you, Job. It seems to be what he's saying. Stop judging God and receive instruction from Him. Then he exalts God's power. Here's one of these great big sections of text. Chapter 36, 24, all the way through 37, 24. Which is the end of the chapter, 37. This is the end of Elihu speaking. We can look at all this together. And I want you to consider this, and we'll again begin with this Wednesday night. Elihu exalts the powerful God of judgment he has just told Job about, and he's just presented to Job. And instead of judging God, Elihu says, you need to exalt Him. Verse 24. Remember that you should exalt His work of which men have sung. According to Elihu, what's Job done? Well, he's judged him. He says, you shouldn't do that. So, we'll pick up here Wednesday night, the Lord willing, and we'll look at this big section of text as a whole, because it's very possible. And I'm not saying that is exactly what's being said, but I want you to consider something that's very, very possible in terms of how all that big section of text fits together. So, look that over before Wednesday night, and then we'll talk about it in class. Thank you for your participation in your attendance.